Okay, it's time to commit. 2024 is the year for prioritizing yourself. Begin your new smile journey with Byte, and you could start seeing results in just 2 to 3 weeks. Just order your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95 at Byte.com. Byte Clear Aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces. Plus, they offer financing options, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA, FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte. This episode is brought to you by Philo. Do you love TV? Do you love saving money? Then Philo is your solution. Philo has shows, movies, and live TV for just $25 a month. You can even try it for free with their 7-day free trial. No contracts, no commitments, no hassles, just a better way to watch TV. Never miss a minute of shows like the hit docuseries Where is Wendy Williams? Or classics such as Friends. If you can't get enough TV, then there's no better way to watch. Philo has more than 70 channels like BET, MTV, and AMC. And the best part? You can try it yourself with their 7-day free trial. Sign up today at philo.tv/poppods. That's philo.tv/poppods to get 50% off your first month.
Hi, this is Zach Stevens from Machines of Grace, and you are listening to Rob and Mark from... Mark and John. Hi, this is Zach Stevens from Machines of Grace, and you are listening to Mark and John from Talking Metal. Crank it up.
Guys, welcome to a special edition here of Talking Metal. A lot of great stuff going on that I wanted to tip you guys off to. One is Mars Ares show on Bionic Striegel Radio. We're going to play an interview from it today by Dave Menichetti from YNT.
Yeah, I saw YNT open up for Ace a couple of times back in the 80s, late 80s. Maybe we'll post one of these old photos where I had the exact haircut of Dave Menichetti, and James Lomenzo from White Lion used to say that I was like the teen version of Dave Menichetti back then.
Cool. It was a great band, YNT. Such a history. If you're not familiar with them, go check them out. They date all the way back to the, I think, the 70s. Yesterday and Tomorrow, they were originally called, and Dave is the ringleader of it all. So this is our good friend Victor. He does numerous metal shows out of his home in Spain. Some you can get in podcast form. Others stream on the stream, BionicStriegelRadio.com or TalkingMetalLive.com. You can check him out there on Thursdays at 8 p.m. East Coast time. I guess that would be 5 p.m. West Coast time. But anyways, we're honored that Victor is letting us air this interview he conducted with Dave from YNT. Here it is.
Hey, everyone. This is Dave Menichetti from YNT, and you're listening right now to Mars Attacks.
Hey, everyone. Welcome aboard another episode of Mars Attacks. This is Victor. You know me as Mars Ares 2005 from the Talking Metal Forums. For those of you that have come from the Talking Metal Forums, the intro there was from the legendary guitarist and leader of YNT, Dave Menichetti, who I had the pleasure and the luck to interview earlier this week. They were here in Spain, starting off the Spanish part of their European tour here in Santander, which is a city that I'm closest to. And I got to tell you, Dave was very down to earth. No attitude whatsoever with him at all. I had asked for a fraction of the time to speak to him, and I think I could have spoken to him for forever. For those of you that don't know, his father just did pass away. I did speak to him slightly regarding that. I gave him my condolences, and I'm very appreciative that they actually were able to schedule me in for the interview due to the fact that there was such a difficult situation within the Y&T camp and the Dave Menichetti family. And I didn't know until the last moment that I was going to have the ability to, or I was going to be granted permission to speak to him or not. So I do want to thank, you know, his wife and manager Jill for arranging this, and to Dave for giving me what I think is a really great interview. I think you guys will feel that as well. I did have to edit out the beginning of the interview just because there were some technical issues on my end, but everything more or less straightened itself out. But without further ado, let me play a quick track from Y&T and just jump right into the interview afterwards.
You were running a game on me. What I wanted to discuss a little was the tour that you guys are doing right now. You guys have just started a second leg of a European tour now in October, and you started off in Ireland, and tonight's the first night in Spain.
Right.
One of the oddities here, not so much oddities, is that in the north of Spain, we hardly get any bands, hardly any international bands, but looking at the tour dates on your website, Y&T has played here the last 5 years. Why is that?
Well, I mean, I have to credit that mostly to the promoter, because he's always been so good about, you know, moving us around the country.
Mm-hmm.
Robert is our guy, and he's always tried to do that. He's tried to make sure that each year that we come back, that we, you know, try to hit some different places. And, you know, I mean, I leave it all up to his expertise, and he's never been wrong. I mean, the first time we played Bilbao, I wasn't even aware of Bilbao that much at the first time we came, and it was just like, wow, amazing. So, you know, as each time we hit someplace new, of course, it's a new experience for us, but we're happy to certainly, you know, try to tread into new territory each time.
Sure, and I think the good thing here for those people that aren't aware of the geography, Bilbao isn't all that far away. It's a 45-minute car ride, more or less. So
right.
It isn't that far-fetched that people from Bilbao or from Asturias, which is the province to the left of us, would actually join in and come see the show tonight. And absolutely, looking at the dates there, you obviously see that he has spread you guys out throughout the entire north of Spain. With the tour so far, I'm assuming that everything has gone fairly well?
Yes, yeah, it's been fine. We've had some really good shows so far. We have, you know, for some reason or another, always seem to have avoided Ireland, so that was our first sort of foray into our own headline thing over there. We'd been there before with AC/DC, but that was many, many years ago in Dublin, but had never been up to Belfast. So again, you know, we're trying to get out and tread into some new territories or some territories that we should have been at so many times before, but you know, for one reason or another, we hadn't hit. So it's been good. And then of course we went up to Scandinavia and played in Norway and in Sweden, which are, you know, pretty big strongholds for Y&T anyway. The mm-hmm. Swedish fans have been great to us for years, so it's a nice thing to always get back to those areas.
Excellent. So I guess Scandinavia is what has stood out the most so far from the tour, or is there any?
No, I'd say they've all been really good. I mean, again, because we hadn't been in Ireland, I think the fans were especially crazy, and you know, it was like, wow, you know, finally, you know, so, you know. It was great. I mean, both Dublin and Belfast, they were just, you know, tremendous, just so loud. And again, the same thing in Scandinavia, everywhere we've gone so far, you know, Germany and Holland, it's all been great. We're lucky, you know. I mean, that's the way I look at it. We're lucky people to have the fans that we do.
Right. Well, I think it's really interesting because looking at all the dates that you guys are doing, you have other bands out there that probably broke it big around the same time that you guys did, towards the early to middle 80s, and they play 5 festivals, and they call that a tour. They put out a DVD and release all these different press releases and everything else, and that's a tour. And you guys are actually touring how many months out of the year? I mean, this European leg lasts until November, more or less, and then you have dates in December in the States. So I think that's really a testament not only to the fans, but to the actual material that you guys present, that after all these years, people still want to go out and see Y&T night after night.
Yeah, well, you said it perfectly. Absolutely. I think that's exactly right, too, because, you know, we've been asked so many times, you know, what is it about this, you know? Why are so many people into you still and everything like that? And I think it does come down to the material, you know, first and foremost. And then, of course, you know, the fact that we always do a good show live. I mean, we just, you know, our hearts are in the performances. There's never, ever been a question about that. We're not the kind of band that, even though we've been around for a long time, that we
take that for granted. You know, when you see us on stage, we are not going through the motions. We truly enjoy every moment we're on stage. So I think that reflects to the fans, you know, and they pick that up, and you know, and of course, you know how that is. It's the fans and the band interaction every night that makes for a great show. So
sure. And I agree with you 100% there. I mean, I've seen bands come here and check was in the mail and they were sort of up there, you know, going through the motions. And I actually went on a message board and mentioned something like that and had a band member of a somewhat famous band that I won't mention actually give me all types of excuses. But people are paying to see you give it your all every night. And obviously, yes. If not, you know, you wouldn't be around going through, you know, all the different fads that have come and gone. You guys are still here, you know.
Right.
So, as far as the people that are coming to the shows, have you seen anything with, say, the new age of the video game era with Guitar Hero or Rock Band or things like that influencing younger people coming to see the shows? Are the ages more or less the same? What are you seeing out there in the crowd?
Well, it's funny you say that because somebody had just asked me that earlier, and you know, like a couple of days ago, and just before we were going on stage, and then we went on stage, and I looked out, and there were all kinds of young guys, you know, standing in front, and
right.
I thought, wow, okay, well, yeah, there you have it. I mean, certainly we've been seeing it all along for the last couple of years, especially. A lot of young teenagers and you know, coming to the shows. And you know, rockers. You know, I mean, they've got the shirts on. They're, you know, they look the part. It's just, you know, and they're totally getting into the songs. And a lot of them are singing, you know, every lyric. So they've already, you know, obviously attuned themselves to Y&T already before they've come.
Right.
So you know, it's great. I mean, I can't say that I'm completely surprised, but I will say that it's nice to see it, you know, because you never know as you go along with your career whether or not, you know, you're going to incorporate into that some new fans along the way and young fans at that. So, you know, it's great to see that happening. It's obviously not happening just to us. It's happening to a lot of what I would consider sort of legacy bands of the
sure.
70s and 80s and 60s even sometimes, you know, whatever. So it's good because, you know, I mean, all music eventually starts from somewhere, you know,
mm-hmm.
and I think that, you know, to some degree, the 60s and 70s artists, you know, kind of started something, you know, that everybody else took from at some point along the way,
mm-hmm.
and certainly used something of that. And I think that it's good that you know, young kids can still have the opportunity to see some of these bands that started stuff from day one. I mean, they can still come out and see a band like, you know, I don't know, there's any number of them that are still playing out there, you know, obviously,
mm-hmm.
you know, AC/DC and a band like, you know, Jesus, there's so many of them, Deep Purple and so on and so forth, you know, that were guys that we all kind of listened to get our own kind of licks, you know,
right.
when we were going about. So, you know, they're the forefathers of it all, I suppose.
Absolutely. And I agree with you. And like you're saying, with these legacy bands, obviously they're with any generation of music, you only have probably a select number that survive and go all the way to the end or it can continue to play at the same level. And obviously
right.
you guys are still there. So,
right. Yeah.
As far as the gear that you guys are using, does it vary at all from what you guys are using here in Europe to what you're using in the States?
Well, it has been a little bit. Last year, well, actually earlier this year, I should say, when we first came out in June,
mm-hmm.
There was a manufacturer of amplifiers out here, Peter Diesel, that was a big fan of the bands, and he had gotten a hold of us and said, would you guys like to use my amplifiers on this tour? And, of course, I was unaware. I'd heard the name Diesel Amplifiers, but I'd never played through them. So.
Right.
We just, you know, but I checked with some guitar player buddies of mine. They're like, oh yeah, those are great. You know, those are like killer amps. So I was like, well, all right, let's just go for it. You know, and so, you know, the first night of the tour in June, I think we were playing in Paris, and we, you know, we just wanted to make sure we had enough time to do a decent sound check. So. So in case these amps were, you know, not cutting it for us, that we could get something else in there. But man,
right.
From the first note on the, you know, once I dial it in, it was like, these are amazing. So that's the difference. The difference is that now we come back again this time, and again, Peter Diesel has supplied us with the amplifiers. So we are playing different amplifiers than we do when we're on our own home turf right now.
Right.
When we're at home, the guitar players mostly play with, I play with a Mesa Boogie, and so does John, but John also brings his PV Classic amplifiers out, which sound really good. So,
okay.
So that's kind of what the differences are. But as far as the drums go, you know, Mike is using his favorite kit out here, which is a Yamaha kit.
Mm-hmm.
He loves Yamaha drums, and so it's the same thing that he's got basically at home. And Phil always gets an SVT and a jazz bass and everything. So that's all the same. Everything's pretty much the same except for our guitar players' rigs. And again,
right.
I have to credit Peter Diesel for that, because those amplifiers are killer. And I now want one, of course, for home. So I'm going to take one home with me.
Excellent. As far as the guitars that you're using, they're still the same Les Pauls that you're using over in the States, same Yamahas and so on?
Yeah, except that we can't bring them all out here because of the restrictions from flying.
Right.
You know, unfortunately, we're lucky that we can even take two guitars over here because of just, you know, it costs so much money if we were to bring extra baggage with us. It's
right.
You know, every flight would end up, we could buy the guitars all over again if we did that. So
right.
So basically, I bring two guitars with me. I bring my old classic 68 Les Paul, and I bring a Strat with me, and usually that Strat is my blue Strat because it's my favorite one.
Oh, okay. And there was actually a company that was making a Menichetti model guitar as well, wasn't there?
Right. Yes, that's right. And I brought that on the road in 2006. In fact, when we did the DVD, that was the guitar I was playing, because my Les Paul at that time was not in any shape to be played. In fact, the neck was being repaired on it, so. So I took that the Bechelia guitar and I brought it with me, and it was just killer. It's a great guitar, and I love playing it. But boy, is it heavy! It kills me after about, you know, 2 hours on stage, man, to have that 11-pound monster around my neck.
Wow! Yeah, I mean, obviously, if you're used to you know, the weight of your Les Paul or the Strat. You know,
right,
going for that, and especially under those extremes where you don't have a choice. It's either that or nothing, more or less, you know?
Exactly, yeah.
So,
well, no, and I love that guitar. It's certainly not a second choice kind of
right.
thing, it's just that, you know, obviously the weight difference made a difference in the long run. My Les Paul's about 9 pounds, and I think that Bechelia is right around 11. And the 2 pounds doesn't seem like that much, but... you throw 11 pounds around your neck for 2 hours.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. I'm with you there. Let me dial the clock back a few years here. And looking back at all the videos you guys did, it seems as if all your videos were on par with everyone else's videos of that time. If you look at anything like Don't Stop Running or Contagious or Mean Streak, they all were, in my opinion, on par with the Twisted Sister videos or the Rat videos or Motley Crue's. Anyone else out there? Was there any competition between the bands to see who could top who with their next video?
You know, it probably was. I mean, I think in our regard, you know, we were just, you know, young and dumb. You know, I mean, when it came to videos, we kind of showed up at the video shoot. We heard what the concept was that the promoter, I mean the producer had or whatever,
mm-hmm.
and we gave our ideas, but you know, at that point, you know, these guys already had their ideas and they weren't going to listen, you know, so it was kind of out of our hands to some degree. I plead a little ignorance in that regard. We probably should have been a little bit more on top of really saying what we wanted to do, because,
right.
you know, the one thing that we hated was videos where, you know, musicians that were actors,
right.
you know, and had to play a part, you know, and it was always better if we could just do some sort of thing that that showed the band playing, you know, in a live capacity. I think that would have been better for all of us had we had more opportunities of that in every one of our videos. So, you know, those are my pet hates about you know, our videos and so many videos that were gone, mm-hmm. that had gone out at that time, is that, you know, I wish we had had more of this sort of live, you know, kind of vibe to our videos. Than we ended up doing one that was sort of more of a live thing, and that was for Don't Be Afraid of the Dark, but it wasn't played very often. It was sort of at the end of Geffen's reign with Y&T, which was a very short-lived one. And
right.
So, you know, they just didn't really push it very much.
Which is coincidentally, the if I'm not mistaken, the two albums that have not been remastered, correct?
Correct. Yeah. And the reason that they weren't remastered was that at the time, when we were first starting to come back with these remasters, those two records were still available from Geffen. And so, you know, uh-huh. we would have to have done something different in order to have, I mean, we would literally have had to take the masters in and redone them again, and which actually I wouldn't mind doing, because the 10 record in particular is one that I think really could use a remastering, because mm-hmm. Though the mix was okay, it was a bit thinner sounding than certainly we recorded it with, and so it would be nice to get that back and sort of just fatten it up a bit and get it back
sure.
out there again. Yeah.
And what a lot of people don't realize as well is when they converted a lot of these old vinyl albums to CD, they screwed up the mastering altogether. So that's what's
oh, yeah.
great about all of these reissues,
yeah.
where you're actually hearing the albums like they were intended to initially sound.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, because of the fact that it's now, you know, 2009, and we've gotten so far along with, you know, conversion from analog to digital, you know.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, the original analog to digital conversions, as you were sort of, I think, you know, talking about, were pretty bad. I mean,
yeah.
You know, in fact, it was much better if you had a decent turntable,
mm-hmm.
you know, to just keep listening to your analog than to listen to some of those remasters. I mean, they were just horrid.
Yeah.
So, you know, now, you know, we've got much better gear, and people are so much more, you know, hip to how to do things, you know. So it's great, and we can get these analog masters back from, you know, from the archives, and a lot of times they have to be what they call you know, baked, because
right.
the tape gets so fragile that as soon as it goes across the tape head one time, it starts shedding all of the tape off. So
right,
you
right.
have to literally put it into a very low oven temperature kind of baking process in order for it to sort of like seal the tape back on to the material before you play it again. So you just basically do that, and you can get these amazing, punchy, happening analog masters back, and then, you know, take them into the digital domain the right way now. And
mm-hmm.
it really is a good thing.
Well, did you have any issues remastering the other albums with the tapes themselves, or were they all fine when you actually got your hands on them?
They were all pretty much in decent shape. I mean, obviously, they all had to be baked again,
mm-hmm.
because these are, you know, tapes that are well older than 10 years. And so, yeah, but, you know, they came to us in really decent shape. I mean, obviously, there's some things that happen with any tape, no matter what, you know, when it gets to a certain age, where, you know, you start losing some frequencies a little bit, or some other frequencies bump up a little bit. You
right.
know, it's just the typical, you know, stuff that happens in a sort of technical way. But the guys that know how to master correctly, they've already seen that a lot of times come across their palate, so they just know exactly what to do. You know, they know, okay,
right.
now, yeah, this is it. We got to take this bump down here and add a little more top end that was missing now, and this and that. So it all comes together pretty well. But it's just nice to have those analog masters, because the digital masters that they made from the analog masters when they first went to digital,
mm-hmm.
like I said, are so terrible that you don't want to make your masters off of those. You want
right.
to go back to the original source, you know?
Right. I agree with you completely. Again, you hit the nail right on the head. A lot of those old albums, if you were to continue to listen to them on vinyl, sounded a million times better than those initial CDs.
Yes.
Who is the oddest person that's come up to you and mentioned that you were an influence to their playing, or someone that would surprise other people that they mentioned you as an influence?
That's a good question. You know what? Almost every year, there are at least two or three guitar players that I've met, you know, mm-hmm. that I had never had a chance to meet before, but were, you know, famous guys that will say something like that to me. And unfortunately, right at this particular moment, I'm drawing a blank as to what persons I can say exactly, but. It never fails to amaze me that there are some people out there that I thought wouldn't have known me from anybody, you know, mm-hmm. that said, oh man, you know, you were one of my faves, you know? And I was like, wow, you're
right.
Kidding me. Wow. How that's cool. That's really nice to hear. And, you know, and then I hear some other things, you know, third party from other people. And, just trying to remember. Somebody just told me something like a couple of months ago that was really surprising to me. That Billy Gibbons, that's right, mm-hmm. ZZ Top's guitar player, had mentioned something really nice about me, and I thought, wow, I didn't even know he knew I was alive, man.
Right.
You know, and he said, you know, if there's one rock guitar player that can play the blues, it's Dave Menichetti. And I thought, did he really say that, or are you just jiving me, you know? But
right.
Sure enough, it was in like an article or something that he had fairly recently had wow. an interview with somebody. And I thought, well, damn, man, that's cool. You know, because I remember when I was first starting to play guitar, that, you know, in a rock band at least, you know, that Billy Gibbons was like, you know, he was an influence for me because I was so into bluesy kind of playing, and mm-hmm. he was, you know, to me at that time, one of the ultimate blues hard rock guitar players, you know,
mm-hmm.
sort of was able to put that together. So, yeah, and so things like that happen to me every year, and it does sort of, you know, put me in a place where I'm like, wow, really? I mean, not that I'm trying to, you know, put down my legacy as a guitar player or whatever, mm-hmm. but it just, you know, you don't know how far reaching a particular artist can be to other people.
Sure.
You just have no, there's no way you could know, you know, until you eventually either meet these people or hear about them from somebody else. But,
mm-hmm.
so yeah, I mean, it obviously makes me proud. I feel good about it. But it's very strange, you know. I have this thing about me where I kind of disassociate the Dave Menichetti, you know, musician part from the Dave Menichetti person part.
Sure.
And it's kind of like, you know, they're two separate entities all living together. In other words, I don't take myself seriously. In other words, I guess that's the easiest way to say it. You know,
right.
I mean, it's like I really appreciate all of that, but I just love what I'm doing, you know, and it's not that... that big of a deal to me to just go out there and have a great time and play and get off on what I'm doing. That's just part of my life, you know. I don't consider myself special by any means.
Well, that's definitely great to hear, because you interview so many bands that, or you read interviews from so many bands that have had a tenth of the popularity that you've had, and you know, it seems like they have a great big ego and need to be stroked constantly. And it's awesome to speak to someone of your stature to actually, you know, look at things in that perspective. So.
Well, you know, I think that, you know, to some degree, when as we were getting, you know, popular, you know, coming up in the ranks, I noticed that there was a certain trend that was happening. And, you know, this isn't to say that it's always like this, but to me it seemed like the people that were the least popular had the biggest egos.
Right.
Because you know, I think they were just trying to, you know, assert themselves to everybody, like, look at me, man, I'm great, you know,
right.
You got to check me out, you know, because they didn't have any sort of, you know, confidence in themselves that have been, you know, sent to them from all the fans and everything, you know, they
yeah.
hadn't sort of, you know, become themselves yet, you know, with everyone
right.
else and felt good about it. Now, it's not to say that there aren't a bunch of assholes out there, too. I mean, you know, there's always those guys, you know, no matter
yeah.
how popular they were and how, you know, how well they already know that they're confident and whatever, you know. I mean, there's certainly some guys out there that, you know, I can't talk to personally. I mean, they'll come up to me and be fans of ours, but I'll just be like, you know, I don't want to hang with them, you know, because
right.
they're just not, you know, because, you know, most, but I'll tell you what, from my standpoint, most of the guys, and maybe it's just because we're, you know, fellow musicians and they're nice to me or whatever, but
mm-hmm.
most of the guys that I've met over the years that are the biggest names are the nicest guys. Mm-hmm. And again, maybe it's because they've already done it, and they've got their confidence in themselves. They're not trying to prove themselves at every last second. You know what I
right.
mean? You know, so they already know. They okay, I did it. I'm fine with myself now. So it's cool. Everything's normal. You know, but I think that's true to some degree. And then sort of like some of the mid level guys, there's a few still jerks out there, and you know, but I don't want to talk about them because they spew their name all over the place, their own self. So
right. Vice versa to the previous question that I asked you, are there any contemporary players out there that you listen to, or newer bands that you actually listen to that may surprise people?
I think that if people were to look at what was on my MP3 player, everything would surprise them. Because I listen to all kinds of music. That's the thing. I always have. And, before I probably put my first note to a Yesterday and Today or a Y&T song, you know, I was listening to pop. I was listening to jazz a lot. Mm-hmm. I was listening to R&B and blues and opera and classical music and all this kind of stuff. And my head was into everything.
Mm-hmm.
But my heart and soul were into the hard rock thing and,
sure.
and the bluesy kind of hard rock and things like that. So those are the kinds of things that I listen to this day. I mean, on my MP3 player, I have Pavarotti, I have I have Henry Mancini, I mean, stuff that you'd be like, what?
Right.
and at the same time, I've got, great blues guitar players on there and tons of jazz.
Mm-hmm.
I'm a jazz freak. I love fusion. I love old time jazz. I love everything. So, and it's funny too, because we have, our drummer in the band that's been with us for almost 4 years now,
mm-hmm.
Mike Vanderheul, he's like the only guy that I've had in any Y&T, organization that has been like a jazz fan. So we're like, wow, hey, did you see this one? We went out and bought the Frank Sinatra Live at the Sands, CD with the great band behind him and everything,
mm-hmm.
and we're like getting off on that. So yeah, there's probably a whole lot of people that would should be shocked by the stuff that I listen to. But as far as new rock bands are concerned, I really don't listen to the radio that much anymore, and so the only time I really see these guys is if I happen to see them on some live thing on TV, or we play with them,
Right.
And that's the kind of the thing that happens to me, is that I just end up finding out about it that way. I'm sort of one of those guys that just kind of listens to whatever I listen to and doesn't really, bone up on all the latest stuff when it comes to my own, kind of music that we're out there doing. But
right.
we played with a band just the other day that I thought was really impressive. It was a band called Evergrey that opened up for us in Norway. And I thought, wow,
mm-hmm.
these guys are great. I mean, this is sort of more heavy. I don't know what they call that kind of music exactly. But some people say, oh, that's the death metal or the this or that. But, I didn't get that from it. But
right.
Yeah. It was, there's the little kinds of bands that I see every year that I go, wow, man, these guys are happening, good stuff. But no, I don't have anybody that I could, this is a long answer, I'm sorry, that I could just point to right now and say, no, this is who I'm listening to now. This is the shit.
No, but I think that still you gave me a pretty good answer there, because, I mean, obviously, one of the detriments to hard rock or to metal is that people just think that you have to listen to just hard rock or metal to be a great musician or true to that music. Like you, I have absolutely everything under the spectrum, on my iPod or on my computer. So, it's almost at a fault that people don't pull things from different types of music, things that they like and embed it into what they truly love.
So. Oh yeah, absolutely, man. And because I think that makes you a better songwriter anyway, because
right.
you've got ideas from melodies from all over the place. It didn't just come from a the same thing in this tight little corner,
Right.
You got to expand your knowledge, But I think that goes as a compliment to lots of musicians out there that are just fans of music in general. I'll tell you, in the 70s, we did not get into this music because because of, you know, hard rock and hard rock itself. I mean, we got into being musicians because we love music primarily, you know, and with that means all good music, you know, that that so many of us appreciated. It wasn't just me, believe me. I mean, Leonard listened to everything. Phil listened to everything, you know. I mean, Phil and I would sit up nights and listen to Stevie Wonder albums, you know, and with our headphones on and just be totally into it, you know.
Right.
And, you know, and but at the same time, then we'd put Skid Row on or something, you know, or, you know, whatever, or Mountain or, you know, any number of things that were completely different. But, you know, so it's all just a love of music that, that, and it ends up translating, I think, into your own music in the long run. You know, all that melody is going to have to come out some way or another, you know?
Right. Well, I think that's an interesting point, too, because a lot of people want to put the different types of music into subgenres and put it all, tie it all up into a nice little bow, into a nice little package. And instead of looking at music as good or bad music, which is what I prefer, you know, because you either like something or you don't like it. And it really doesn't matter where it comes from as long as it's good.
Yeah, exactly. And thankfully, there are some people that, you know, in some of these festivals can deal with that same kind of thing, like, you know, Sweden Rock in particular. Here's a festival where you'll see somebody, you know, that is completely different from each other go on stage right after each other, you know, and yet, you know, the crowd is into it all, you know, you can get Yes and Twisted Sister on the same stage, you know, and Y&T and, you know, I don't know, any number of other bands that are just like completely different, you know, something that would be death metal or something, you know, or even, you know, earlier than that, you know, somebody like Ian Anderson or something like that, you know, going on stage. So you know, those are nice to see every once in a while, because that's how it was when we first started out. I mean, all music that was not, you know, obvious sort of popular music, what they called it at that time, you know, would have just gone on the rock radio station. You know, you would hear somebody that was kind of like, almost like folksy, like a Richie Havens. This is back in the 60s and 70s, you know, Richie Havens or even Crosby, Stills, and Nash being played with a Jimi Hendrix and Led Zeppelin and a band like Tower of Power with horns and everything. That was all considered rock, you know. It was just, now there's like 50 different types of rock. It's like, man, why?
Right.
You know? I understand, though, because, you know, certainly there are certain types of rock music bands that, that all try to sound a particular way that, you know, I could see where you all kind of want to have your own thing, you know, but, you know, I can still see the validity for it all being included together in one thing.
Sure, absolutely. Based on some of the answers that you've given me, can we expect to see a Dave Menichetti jazz album in the future?
Probably not, but you know, though I listen to it, that doesn't necessarily mean I can do well as a musician doing it. Although I can say that I did try somewhat when Y&T first broke up in '91, and there were quite a few years in the '90s where we just weren't doing anything. Yeah, I sort of threw my attempt at it. I had a keyboard out in the studio, which I don't play very well, and which has actually helped me a little bit, because by putting my hands in places I didn't know where I was going to go, I actually created some ideas for myself.
Sure.
Yeah, I mean, I kind of did sort of three quarters of a fusion record to some degree, and it's, I don't know, maybe it's pretty good. I don't know. Maybe I might attempt it one of these days, but I did, of course, you know, come up with something that was more on the blues side kind of thing, and I really got off on that. That was great. That was good fun, and I probably will do another one of those records coming up, maybe in the next year or so.
Ah, excellent. So that would be the next studio venture that we would see from you or from Y&T would be possibly another blues album?
No, that will be the second next thing you'll see, because Y&T is actually going to do a new record.
Excellent.
Yeah, and we decided to do that last year, and we stuck to it. And earlier this year, in January and February, when we had some time off, the band started, you know, sitting down and really getting serious about songwriting. And over the last course of the last maybe 7 months or so, we've tuned that in a little bit more, and now I'd say we have probably three quarters to, you know, certainly an album's worth, if not more than an album's worth of material, but I think that we're only about three quarters of the way there. When we get home from this tour, and after doing a few more shows at home, we'll have some more time to finish all the ideas that I think that we need to for the next record and record it and get it out hopefully before summer of next year.
Excellent. I absolutely look forward to that, and I'm sure a lot of other fans will as well. Are you still a Raiders fan by any chance?
Yeah, I'm looking at my Raiders T-shirt that I have sitting here on the bed. I was a big Raiders fan. My dad was like the head, Raiders president of the Boosters team, and you know, all that kind of stuff. The club, rather. And we were into it. We had season tickets for years, and I spent a lot of my teenage years and 20s and 30s and everything, you know, going to Raider games. I mean, mm-hmm. That was part of my life, you know. And so it's embedded in me to some degree. But, mm-hmm. I've been so busy as a musician lately that I haven't spent as much time in the football thing, because a lot of times we're touring when football is on right now, and
right. We're
out of the country, so I don't have a chance to even watch it. But
sure.
But when I get home, come Sunday, I'm sitting there in front of the TV all day watching all the games. So I'm still a big football fan. Mm-hmm. Raiders, not necessarily 100% anymore, but I'm still a fan.
All right. I appreciate your time. Obviously, you've spent more time with me than what I'd initially asked Jill for. And again, under the circumstances, I do really appreciate you taking the time to do the interview. And I do wish you guys luck with the tour, and do appreciate your time, and good luck with the show tonight and the rest of the tour. And I can't wait to hear the album when it comes out.
All right. Cheers, man. I appreciate it.
All right. Thanks.
Nice talking to you.
Yeah, likewise.
Okay.
All right.
Take care.
You too. Bye.
Will you please welcome, for their farewell performance, the one and only, the fucking baddest, YNT!
Was a little YNT right here on Talking Metal, courtesy of Victor, aka Mars Aries 2005, from the Talking Metal forums and from his great show on Striegel's Bionic Radio.
Bionic Striegel Radio. Mars Attacks. Yeah. Mars Attacks every Thursday at 8 o'clock. So check that out. A long time ago, I did an interview with these guys from Machines of Grace. Kind of forgot about it, and it's been sitting on my hard drive. I just stumbled across it. Are you down with airing it, even though it's quite dated at this point?
Yeah, man. I think it's cool. It's a historical piece of Talking Metal history.
Yeah, about 2 months ago, I met up with them right outside of Rockefeller Plaza there where I work. And hooked up the Mac laptop and we recorded an interview. So here is Machines of Grace from Massachusetts on Talking Metal. We'll end today's show with some of their music.
Definitely, guys. Thanks for tuning in. Go to www.talkingmetal.com. Check the news section. Check the reviews. Check out our YouTube page. We got a really cool 8 or 9 minute piece with Ace Frehley up there, if you haven't already seen that. So lots and lots of content on talkingmetal.com. And if you really want to be cool, go to the store section and buy a t-shirt.
Yeah, please. Show your support.
Hey, this is Mark Striegel of Talking Metal, and we are here with Zach and Jeff from Machines of Grace. Welcome to New York.
Thanks for having me, Mark. Pleasure to be here.
You guys are staying pretty busy doing a lot of press while you're in town?
Oh, absolutely. We're just starting today, but we've got the whole weekend planned out, and we are going to be speaking with Eddie Trunk on Monday. So, yeah, we're here doing what we can to promote our project.
Cool. And there will also be a New York City gig at some point, right?
We are playing Club Europa on September 13th with a metal band from San Diego, a band called Cage, which I actually worked with some years ago. Sabotage did a tour on the West Coast, and Cage was the opener. So this was probably 6 years ago. But anyhow, this will be our debut performance in New York City.
Cool. And for you New York listeners, that's out in Brooklyn in Greenpoint. Cool. I want to talk about the band and give the Talking Metal listeners a little history lesson on the Machines of Grace. A lot of people might not know that you guys aren't exactly a brand new band. You were together back in the day. This is your first record. But let's talk about the history going all the way back to, I guess, what, 1990?
Yeah, that's actually where it all began. I met Zach in Boston. He had a connection and a relationship with our guitar player, Matt Leff, from the Musicians Institute in California. And Zach came from California out to Boston. Matt and I had been playing together, working on some songs and ideas. And knowing Zach and knowing the vocalist that he was, we flew Zach to Boston, and the story began.
Yep, and back at that time, we pretty much circumvented the New England circuit. We started out playing Boston, clubs right in the center of Boston. We branched out to New Hampshire, Vermont. I guess Providence, Rhode Island was a big, yep, you know, venue for us. Maybe a few little things in Connecticut. So really the New England, you know, area was the place that we really, you know, came alive and, you know, played all these songs. This Machines of Grace record is really a celebration of all the songs that we played back then, with a little tweaks here and there to bring it into the year 2009. Obviously, I'm not going to be doing some of the Jeff Tate screams that you would hear in 89, just because it doesn't fit right now. But the thing about the music, the surprising thing about the music was, being the pure rock genre it was, if you just listen to the music alone without vocals, it's timeless. There's certain types of music you can make that don't really react over time. You can't really put a date on them. So luckily, this is the kind of music we write. It takes very little bit of adjustment from a vocal standpoint, from a vocal melody and, you know, lyricist, you know, type standpoint, to bring it right into where we are right now and to almost create something that people are kind of looking for that they're missing right now. So it's kind of worked out lucky for us with Machines of Grace, where, you know, 80% of the music that we performed back then, heck, if we go back and play Boston House of Blues one day, our fans are going to show up and they're going to hear the songs and they're going to hear small differences, but the best thing is they're going to recognize the songs, you know, and you know, we added a few things for the new album, changed a few things around, turned some songs into like acoustic songs that weren't really acoustic songs back then, but really fit well now in that genre. And we're just happy to go back and be able to do it again the right way. We didn't really have a chance to finish our dream. You know, I call that my first rock and roll dream. That was the first band I was in as a lead vocalist. I was a drummer until then. You know, me and Jeff shared a lot more than just bandmates. We're both drummers. you know, and I decided to make that jump from drums to lead vocalist, and I went to school out in California at Musicians Institute. That's where I met Matt. The first song we ever recorded together was Fly Away, which made it on the album. And, you know, from there we just kind of grew together, and I honed my skills as a lead vocalist, and this was our original, you know, rock and roll dream to try to get a deal. Now, here we are, you know, whatever, 16, 17 years later, we have the resources. The guys in the band have done many, many things in the industry. It you know, now we can really feel like we're going back and doing this thing right, recording these things for the first time in an actual, you know, high-quality performing CD environment, which we didn't have before. You know, we were joking earlier about, Zach, get these lyrics off this board tape from Bunratty's in Boston, you know, 16 years ago. Well, I could make out about 50% of the vocals, but the vocal melody was there. So the vocal melody was strong, and it was coming from my heart, and it might even not be something I might write today, just from the years that have gone by and the things that happen in life. And I write a lot of things about, you know, what happens in life and things that are going on in our country, anything, news stories. And, you know, we were able to, you know, get all that together and piece together what lyrics I couldn't hear on the board tapes and make it work now.
It was unfinished business. We had a great product back then that was rudely interrupted by grunge, which completely changed the whole musical landscape. And then along with that, Zach was presented with an opportunity to sing for Sabotage.
Right.
Yep.
Yeah.
The Wicked Witch band that band back then actually opened up the door for Zach to take a step further. And a year and a half later, he brought me along. So with all of that behind us, you know, we're trying to take advantage of everything that we've learned over those years and the connections we've made.
Cool. Now, you mentioned about updating some of the songs without the, you know, Jeff Tate screams and stuff like that. What else do you guys do as musicians? Is there, maybe neither of you guys are the question to ask this, but do you tune down the guitars? Are there things you do on the drums to update the songs?
Far as myself and the drumming, I mean, it's all stayed very similar. Mm-hmm. There were certainly some things that we changed up because of arrangements and whatever. But what we were doing back in the day was, you know, we were proud of what we had, although it was unfinished. As far as tuning down, yeah, you know, as far as, but here again, we were never in a studio recording all this stuff. So all of a sudden you get into a room and Matt, the producer says, Matt, why don't you try something like this? The next thing you know, there's a different guitar part that completely fills the song out and changes the feel of it. But I think the core of it, I mean, speaking for myself, drumming wise, I cleaned up some stuff that was unnecessary. And I think the end product is a lot cleaner and a lot stronger for it.
Yeah, and as far as tuning down, I know of no instance where we changed the tuning of the guitars.
Just melody changes
and
some lyrics.
They're in scale for the most part. There could be a few that they, you know, tuned down a half a step or whatever to, you know, maybe drop D, drop C on the top string. I'm not real sure. But there's been no tuning differences. You can actually tell that if you compare a circle-to-circle record and then immediately put the MOG record on, you can tell that circle-to-circle tunes down because we're heavy. Machines of Grace doesn't. And that brings out a different style of my vocal, which I really like to explore after all these years, you know. And, you know, I might not be able to do everything I did in 89, but it's really darn close. But no tuning down, I like it. I want the next album to be exactly in the same kind of tuning, exercising that same range of vocals that I'm doing. And
it's something that separates our sound a little bit too from everything else that's going on. I mean, you can listen to the CD and think it's got an 80s flair to it, but I think it's not tuned down, and the vocals just, it fits a certain way around the guitar that today almost everything is tuned down, it seems like. And when you hear our record, it's completely, you hear a difference immediately just in that fact. So it's what we started with, you know.
Yeah.
So we didn't want to mess with that.
It's played in scale, and it results in a different type of vocal performance.
Right now, it is the month of September, and the holiday season is coming. Do you guys have plans to take a break and go do TSO, or will you just keep going straight with this through the holiday season?
Well, I'll be definitely involved in TSO. I've done the tour every year that it's gone out now. This will be year 11. So as far as, you know, MOG, we've got a few shows coming up beforehand, but obviously when I'm on the road with TSO, it kind of shuts that idea down.
Yeah, I mean, we're just going to wait for that to get done. We'll be working on some new stuff until then. We probably have about a half as much of material as we need for the next Machines of Grace album based on fan feedback. And we're going to work to finish that while he's out there, you know, finishing up his 3 months with TSO. You know, during that time, probably take some time. I got another band called Circle to Circle. We're going to finish up that record, see if we can get that one going. And, you know, it's going to be busy. I took on two full-time bands because, you know, with the economic situation right now, why not? You know, take on two. See how it helps you out. Both of them have a lot to offer. Machines of Grace, the reaction and the impetus in the first 2 months has been something like I've never seen in my career. Even the four Circle to Circle records, I haven't really seen this kind of reaction. So we're probably hitting on something big here. We just got to make sure that we're hitting on the second album the same things we're hitting here.
Follow it up with some live shows too. I mean, like Zach said, the reaction has just been extremely positive. Trying to fit in a live tour or stuff around everything else we've got going
on. In 2010, we're looking at maybe.
Absolutely, yeah, absolutely.
A lot more in 2010.
We have three shows coming up right now. September 12th is the Binghamton Area Metal Fest in upstate New York. September 13th is Club Europa here in Brooklyn, New York. And then September 24th, we're opening for Striper at the House of Blues in Cleveland. So we've got three good opportunities to go out there and, you know, show ourselves off and make some noise, get the buzz going, and then come first of the year next year, we'll be able to set ourselves up and do some more shows.
Yep, that's a good plan.
I mean, this album has barely even dropped, and you guys are already talking about a second album, which I think is pretty cool and exciting and just shows how devoted you guys are to the cause. So there is writing going on already. You have songs ready to go for a second full-length record.
That's true. I mean, I got a song of like 13 new songs from Matt, you know, riffs. Well, that's the way we work. He sends me riffs. I work off that. Me and Jeff, we kind of collaborate on the vocal thing. On the vocal lyrics, and you know,
and plus we had a lot of stuff still left over from years ago that we never finished. Riffs that kind of I used to record all of our rehearsals, so we have riffs upon, you know, parts and parts and parts of things that were never pieced together and done properly. But you know, here again, MOG, the strength of it came from back then, so. Kind of leaning back to some more ideas that we had from that era that are going to, you know, bring that out and dust them off and, you know, finally finish them like you did with this, I think is probably, along with new ideas, obviously, we've all got a bunch of ideas going through our heads at all the time, but I think that is really going to be substantial in filling out the next record.
Yep, and, you know, every time you think about new record, you come modern and you try to, you know, what's heavy now? You know, what's all this? We probably won't even have to use those real heavy riffs that I received. You know, out of the 13 stuff I got from Matt, I'd probably say 7 of it is appropriate because of, you know, the feedback and the stuff that's really strong and getting the best reaction from this record. We don't really have to go match everybody else in what they're doing right now. We've kind of found a genre that we need to stick with, coming from the heart, you know.
Yep, and respect where it came from. So
yeah.
If we try being too modern, we're not going to sound like who we are.
Exactly. So we're going to have to stay with what's working.
There's always a risk that when you try to sound too modern, you come off as being fake.
Yeah, I agree. And you know, as long as it's good riffs, I mean, this band was based on the live sound that you get on our album is the sound. We only had one sound. Paul Hagar says, what do you want us to sound like? Well, we had one.
We
plugged
didn't know any
in
better.
And played. We plugged in and played live shows. Run it like you ran the live sound for 3 years straight front of house. Okay.
Paul is our engineer. Our engineer,
yeah,
and
Paul
producer.
Hagar. And he's worked with Avril Lavigne, Pink. He works with my cousin Butch Walker, who's a famous producer.
That's your cousin?
Yes, that's my first cousin. That's
but
my
Paul,
wife's
Paul was doing
son.
Live sound for us in the Boston area, New England area, back, you know, in the early 90s. So as we all ventured off and did our other professional things, so did Paul. And now he's got a great resume and a lot of
he
experience.
He moved to California.
Yeah, he moved up in the
world. And that's how
he
met Butch. You know, Butch lives in Malibu, and he lives a few towns over. And, you know, whenever Butch doesn't have time, he'll say, mix Avril.
So he
Mix Pink.
He knows firsthand what we were.
What we sounded like.
Yeah, exactly. He was part, you know, initial in forming that years ago. So when we brought him in to do this record, he just basically picked up where he left off. Of course, with a little bit more experience and, you know, some better ideas. Which we certainly benefited from, because some of these
absolutely.
Songs took on a whole new life.
Because he's, you know, producing the brand new artists of today. And this was exactly what he did with us, so we expect that going forward, and you know, it should be really, really neat.
Yep.